Good evening, folks. It's my pleasure to welcome you to what is the last in this second series of lectures and seminars from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. And for those of you who don't know me, my name is Andrew Lyon from the International Futures Forum, and it's been my great privilege to organise or facilitate the lecture and seminar series this year. Back by popular request is Anthony Briog from Birkbeck College in London. Many of you will, of course, know his work from radio and television. But before taking up post at Birkbeck College, he lectured in philosophy at St Anne's College in Oxford. And as you know, he has a wide range of publications which cover academic theory, ideas, and so on. In addition to that, many sort of contemporary issues. And his most recent book, covers Among the Dead Cities, and it covers the sort of moral legacy of bombing civilians during the Second World War, which feeds into his interest in human rights and war crimes. I'm not going to say much more about him. I'll just introduce the title in a moment. As far as I'm aware, we have no fire drills planned, so if the fire alarm goes off, there are fire exits to your rear over there and out here. They'll take us back down into West George Street. Let's hope that doesn't happen. And I hope that as many of you as possible will be able to stay for a drink and some snacks afterwards, which will happen through there, we think, in about an hour's time, if that's okay for people. So Anthony takes for his title tonight Civic Humanism and Conversation about the Good, which I hope is something that we'll be taking up in Glasgow in the next year in determining how to make the place Glasgow a healthier city than it is. Over to you, Anthony.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And thank you so much for your invitation here. It's a great pleasure to be back. I had the privilege and great pleasure to be involved at the beginning of this process in talking about the conversation about the good, with specific reference to the idea of improving the health of individuals in society, psychological and physical. And the idea floated and discussed at that time was that at the grassroots level, in a community itself, the hope would be to try to generate a discussion among the folks in that community about health, about lifestyles, about diet and smoking and obesity and exercise and all those other things. But getting there, not because people from the outside have imposed on them need to do it or directions about how to do it, but because somehow or other an organic upswelling of interest in this matter had been generated in that community. And on the practical aspect of that, some of us here today will be talking together tomorrow about how one might get those sorts of initiatives off the ground and going. Further ideas about that, I suppose, because after all, this has been an ongoing project in many communities, and I know here in Glasgow for a long time already. But what I'd like to talk about today, if I may, since my sort of day job really is in ideas and trying to find ways of applying ideas to practical problems in society, is to put together two, on the face of it at any rate, rather disparate matters. One, a very contemporary one, namely the issuing just now, just in the last week or two, by the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, of a consultation document on the ethics of public health. Some of you will very probably have just had this document through the post very recently. And the council set up a working party earlier this year to try to identify topics for discussion in connection with the ethical constraints on public health initiatives from government, from national organisations. And the fact that that discussion has been renewed now, has been had again now, it's of course discussion that in medical ethics anyway is had all the time, is very, very interesting because it comes just at a point in our thinking about public health where I suppose the old-fashioned paternalistic idea of imposing solutions on communities is at its nadir. That's the least popular option for many people. And it doesn't surprise me that this should be on the agenda again, because a couple of years ago I was at a conference in Leverkusen, just outside Cologne, where the Bayer factories are and the Bayer laboratories, talking to a conference of nurses about paternalism in medicine and medical practice. And one of the other speakers they invited to talk here was a doctor, a French doctor from a big practice in one of the Paris Poget, where a big immigrant community, mainly Muslim, and where health problems of a very severe kind are endemic. And he was a specialist in care of diabetes. And he found in this community that very large numbers of young women were suffering from diabetes, but their management of their own condition is extremely poor. Their compliance with the advice and medication and so on they've been given by their practitioners was extremely poor, largely because, of course, they were faced with so many grinding difficulties with childcare and errant husbands and poverty and strife in their family situation, that one of the last things on their mind was, you know, how to look after themselves properly. And he found eventually that the best way to help his patients to manage their affairs was to become very authoritarian with them. He said that he had had an experience with one young woman who kept coming back to his clinic, but who kept failing to comply with the regimen that she'd been prescribed. And he said to her one day, "Look," he said, "what would you like me to do? Would you like me to keep on advising you, or would you like me to tell you that you've got to do this and you can't come back here unless you've done it?" And she said, "The latter." And so he started to be very authoritarian, and she complied, and things improved slightly. And he, of course, felt rather distraught about this, because what he had wanted and all his professional life so far, he wanted a partnership with his patients, and he wanted to explain things to them and feel that that he wasn't being the old-fashioned top-down kind of doctor. And interestingly, his talk, this recounting of this experience to this very, very large gathering of nurses at this international nursing conference, went down very well. A lot of the nurses there thought that their patients would behave themselves better if only they could wag the finger a bit more often. And they weren't entirely sure that this very collegial approach to medical care was as effective as the old, you know, highly starched ward matron regime had been in the happy days of yore. So it's in a way not at all surprising that there should be this anxiety among people who are thinking about public health, and in particular thinking about things like changing diets and getting people to exercise more, to smoke less and to drink less and so on. How you do that, how you get that to work its way through, especially given the fact that, as some of you will of course know, most recently some research findings have brought out very surprising and interesting results. We've seen obesity, both straightforward obesity and morbid obesity, increasing dramatically in the last quarter of a century or more, say a third of a century. But over that same period, on average, energy intake and calorific intake in the population as a whole has gone down. And the reason why obesity has increased, despite the fact that people are actually eating slightly less or taking in fewer calories, is because the practice of walking and cycling and taking any kind of exercise has practically collapsed, and people drive and sit and watch television. All sorts of very profound lifestyle changes have set in which have made this dramatic change. And of course, lack of exercise is not only bad because of weight problems, it's bad for all sorts of other reasons as well. And yet it is the most difficult of the lifestyle habits to change. It's one thing to get people to modify their eating behavior a bit. You can persuade people to, you know, portion control or just leave out one thing that they normally have with their main meal of the day or whatever. But that's relatively simple in comparison to trying to persuade people, especially people who are already overweight and not very well, to get on their bikes or to go down to the gym. It's much harder to do. And that provides a focus for the kind of problem that people are faced with when they think about trying to introduce changes in the health profile of the community. And therefore, as I say, it's not at all surprising that the Nuffield Council on Bioethics should have taken up again this question of how do we bring about these changes, encourage these changes in lifestyle, get people to take more responsibility on the preventive side and looking after their health, without being authoritarian and paternalistic. What is the mechanism? what is the balance between, on the one hand, autonomy of the individual, the respect accorded to a patient or to an individual person or a family and society, and on the other hand, the place and the role of expertise, of knowledge, and of government organisations charged with the responsibility to try to bring about changes in these things. So there's a very, very familiar but very vexed issue. So that's one thing. Now, what I would like to try and set against it is a way of trying to bring in ideas from left field or from an unusual angle in a way that could shed some light on these problems, is to look at the history of a debate. I mean, rather briefly, I'm not going to go into huge detail about this, but the history of a debate about civic humanism, which of course started in classical antiquity, but it wasn't so much a debate as an assumption at that time. And the city-states of the ancient world, the ancient Greek world in particular, the assumption was made that fully enfranchised members of those societies would fulfil a responsibility, a duty, to participate in the self-government of that community, to take a full part in making decisions about all sorts of things, not just about levels of taxation, whether or not to go to war and so on, but how people in that society conducted themselves, what the norms were, even indeed to the extent of what sometimes it was appropriate for people to wear, because as you know, there's been a long tradition of sumptuary laws and rather dislike of rich people flaunting their wealth by wearing garish robes and silk and very expensive stuffs and so on. So it was quite, in its way, meddlesome kind of democracy among the enfranchised. But it was also a very interesting one because, as I say, it was just an assumption. It wasn't something that they debated and decided on, that people should have this very rich, participative place in society, but that's what a society was. But I keep using the expression the enfranchised, a democracy of the enfranchised, because of course the majority of people in those city-states were not enfranchised. Women and children and slaves and mechanicals. And you may remember, those of you who were reading Aristotle in the bath last night, if it was the relevant passage anyway, that Aristotle took the view that, you know, lots of people were natural slaves. It was just, you know, appropriate for them that they be enslaved. It was also natural that there should be people who were mechanics, laborers, that's to say, people whose highest capacity really was to break stones and carry heavy loads and wash the dishes. In fact, Aristotle took the view that slaves were likely to be slightly more intelligent and interesting than laborers, for various reasons, among them being the fact that most slaves, of course, had been captured in warfare and might have been upstanding and interesting citizens in their own communities before being enslaved. But at any rate, the democracy of the enfranchised was a very small one and a very select one. But in it, and the interesting point here for our purposes is that this assumption was made about what it was to be a citizen, what it was to be a member of the polis, the political unity, where the political unity was an ethical domain, a domain interested in the good life for those who were fully participants in it. And it is that idea that was revived and discussed with great vigour and great relish in the Renaissance period. Very often, you know, when people look at the Renaissance and they say things like humanism was a revived interest in the rediscovered texts of classical antiquity, what they fail to notice is that when people became interested in the texts of classical antiquity, they were interested in their content. So they were interested in their discussions about the good life, the good for humankind, the good society in which the good for individuals could flourish. And therefore, especially in Florence, in the 15th, 16th century debate, it was a very lively one about the concept of a citizen, the concept of a republic, thinking of a republic not as we would now, as just a political entity, a state, something with institutions that pervade justice and express the will of the people or the will of the ruling oligarchy or whatever. They thought of a republic as being a community, a cohort of people who felt that they had a common project to which they could contribute and in which they were interested and from which they derived certain sorts of benefits. And in that debate, the Florentine humanists talked always about the health of the republic and the health of the members of the republic. And that by this phrase, they meant the flourishing, the sense of well-being and well-doing, the sense of belonging, the sense of commitment, the sense of achievement that came out of being able to participate in trade and in learning and in artistic endeavour and in building and in making a home and establishing a family and so on. The idea of health, which of course, if you look at the etymology of that Anglo-Saxon expression, means wholeness, a certain completeness or of fulfilment of being, was really this rather rich and inclusive notion. It wasn't just that you didn't suffer from too many colds, it was that you were pleased justly with your position and with your doing, that you had what they recognized Aristotle as having situated as a great ideal, namely eudaimonia, which is that sense of well-doing and well-being that marks out the well-lived and satisfying life. And that is what the Florentine humanists identified as being the desiderata, that the good republic, the good society, is one in which there is a good life, satisfying and fulfilling life for the individual members of that society. But there was a condition, or a set of conditions, attached to being such a citizen, to playing this role. And that was the idea of recognizing and fulfilling certain sorts of responsibilities, taking cognizance of where in the network of relationships that constitute that society an individual found himself. And I use the masculine again for the obvious reason that we're talking about the past, and the past is a sexist domain, as you know. So it was really, again, the question of the enfranchised. So it was the head of the family or the individual male or whoever, but who had a responsibility to play a part and to bear the relevant part of the burden of making that society work. There were no free riders. The idea of just benefiting from the overall flourishing of the city-state without having to put in anything to achieve that flourishing would be a certain kind of anathema. Unless, of course, you were a very senior member of one of the small group of families that ran these institutions, but then you could claim, at any rate, that your family's achievement justified your sitting on your laurels. Everybody else in that society, to be a paid-up member of it, had to be a fully working, contributing member of it. And that meant that each individual had to be sure to be able to keep up to speed with society, had to be informed, had to go along to meetings, had to pull his weight, had to be aware. This was going to be a society, said the humanists, of a society of governors, a society in which everybody was a governor of the whole, so to speak. Everybody was a member of parliament. Everybody was on the committee. Nobody would be outside if genuinely a citizen of this community. And you can see that carries with it all sorts of ideas. It carries with it assumptions about what it is to bring up people, your own children, let's say, those for whom you're responsible, to become full members of such a society. They have to be educated. They have to be educated not only in the traditions of the society and to be literate and numerate and the rest, but to be able to bear arms. One part of the discussion in civic humanism was about an equality in arms, that everybody was equally a soldier with everybody else and could therefore take the full part in the defence of the city. That would be one responsibility. We would now concentrate much more really on the civic virtues that need to be evolved in order for an individual really to play that kind of part. But at that time, conditions of life being what they were, civic virtues and warrior virtues were of equal importance, and everybody had to be equipped in both respects. So you can see that a whole raft of assumptions and attitudes and beliefs about what it is to be capable of being fully a citizen carry with it this idea of the responsibility of the individual. So the conversation that society had with itself was a conversation that just assumed that people knew what was expected of them to be full participants in that. And that's very interesting, because it gave rise, from that idealized beginning in the discussion of the Florentine humanists in particular, it gave rise to several centuries of discussion about how you could turn this ideal republic with its ideal citizens into something practical. And without going through all the different phases and stages of how that conversation worked out, one need only look at the debate in this country, in Britain, in the 18th century, to see how it, under pressure of reality, had transformed itself from a democratic ideal to an aristocratic one. Because in the 18th century, people like Shaftesbury and others, in considering the question of what a good community, a good society would be, it came to the conclusion that such a society could only be good in the ideal way that the Florentine humanists had envisaged it, if it was well led, if it had good leaders, if the people who were responsible for making decisions about the government of the society had a very clear conception of what the good was for everybody in society. In other words, this Florentine humanistic ideal had evolved into the ideal of the genuine aristocratic government of society, whereby aristocrat was meant the best, the people with the clearest vision and the deepest understanding, who had the interests of the community at large at heart, and who were realistic and recognised that the vast majority of people weren't capable of being citizens in the Florentine sense, therefore had to be led and guided and told what to do for their own benefit. It might best therefore be described as the high point of paternalism in a way, which after all is what any aristocratic dispensation is. Now just pause for a moment there, freeze frame for a moment, and just bring up on the screen next to it something that of course the whole humanist tradition was presenting itself as an alternative to. And what the humanist tradition was presenting itself as an alternative to was, of course, the standard view that there is a God in heaven, and the idea of a religious arrangement of the universe was very much a monarchical idea. There is a ruler who hands down divine commands, who tells people how to live and what they are, and how to accept the circumstances in which they find themselves. And which, by the way, provides a whole set of motivations for behaving certain ways, in certain ways, and promises certain kinds of rewards or punishments for not behaving in those ways. It's a very simple and powerful model of how the universe is structured. And there is a parallel, of course, between that kind of vision of the universe and the sort of social structures that have persisted in human society all the way up until the modern period, the monarchical principle, the ruler at the head and the cohort of adjuncts to the ruler, the aristocrats, and then the body of society as a whole, taking direction from it. Now, what the city-states of Renaissance Italy had done was to some extent to break away from that model and to assert an alternative, namely some idealized version of the classical model of the self-governing society, a society which didn't just take its orders from a single individual, a tyrant. Although, footnote, of course, in practice, that's what did happen in some of the Renaissance city-states, of course, but that's not what the Renaissance humanists were aspiring to. So the contrasting models threw up a number of difficulties for people who wanted the humanistic model to be the preferred one, to be the one that actually was applied in society, because whereas in the other model, it says we are born into a universe governed by a benign creator who has certain requirements of us and wants us to live in a certain way, and here are the incentives for living that way. Instead of that, the humanist model has to find different incentives, different reasons for behaving one way rather than another, different motivations for being a good citizen. If a humanist comes to you and says, be a good citizen, give up smoking or whatever, and you say, why? Well, what the humanist can't do is to say, because if you don't, you're going to go to hell or something, then hasn't got that kind of sanction which the other model provides, then what is your answer going to be? Well, it's for your own good. Well, I'm not interested in my own good. I'd rather drink and smoke and live a short and happy life than a long and boring one, that somebody might say. So you have this difficulty of trying to elicit a set of considerations that would be persuasive for people to be good citizens under the humanistic model. As you see, and this is a parenthetical remark, I'm simplifying somewhat here just for brevity and speed, but you can see that there is this interesting contrast, and it's important to remember that the humanistic tradition of debate from the Renaissance afterwards was consciously, self-consciously trying to distance itself from a very different model of the ethical and metaphysical structure of the world in which all sorts of different incentives and motivations existed. But as I said, by the 18th century, the democratic ambitions of the Florentine humanists had, under pressure of discussion and the harsh realities, come to be transformed into an aristocratic version of the world. Actually, in some respects, much, much more like its classical models than like the Renaissance form that it took. And you could pick out the institutions that were set up in the 18th century actually under the influence of this aristocratic humanism. For example, in 1768, the Royal Academy was founded. That is the institution for the promotion of the arts, painting and sculpture in Britain, with the King George III as its patron, and with a remit. If there's going to be an official body with the royal charter, it has to have a role in society. It's got to be there for something, not just a tea shop for painters and somewhere to have a summer exhibition, but it's because the academy is going to have an effect on society. What is that effect going to be? Well, it's going to teach society through the medium of art, and in particular through historic paintings, those massive academic paintings of great moments in history. It's going to teach the society public virtues, what it is to be a member of the society and what this society expects from you. By depictions of the heroic and of the noble, of great moments in history and great achievements of the nation, it's going to inculcate into people a sense of belonging and a sense of responsibility. You see now that humanism is in trying to find ways of reaching the emotions of individuals so that those emotions can impel people to act one way rather than another, has bethought itself that the arts, that culture, might be able to do that job, might be able to reach into the impulses and the emotions of individuals and motivate them to be one way rather than another. It's absolutely fascinating that something like 25 years, quarter of a century before the founding of the Royal Academy, David Hume had, in his Treatise of Human Nature, argued that reason could never ever identify goals for an individual. The only thing that would ever impel an individual to act one way rather than another would be an emotion of some kind. Only a feeling, only a desire, only a response, a reaction could ever be motivating. And so at the height of the second half of the 18th century, therefore, this idea that you could only engage and motivate people and bring them into the project of being good citizens in the humanistic sense anyway, was by reaching out to their emotions. And one way of doing this was to get them to listen to stories, to look at pictures, to open themselves to dramatic representations, and in this way to be moved, think of that expression, we still use it today, to be moved to be a certain sort of person and to act in certain sorts of ways. And this was a direct result of the problem that humanism found in itself, lacking an obvious source of motivation, justification for what it wanted to do in society. And you see that idea, that reaching the emotions of people to motivate them, is a version of the problem that the Nuffield Council is addressing today. The problem of, should we top down tell people what's in their best interests and how they should behave and what they should do and what they shouldn't do? Or is there some other way of trying to engage people from the grassroots level, get them to see, to feel the point, to be moved to take action, to make changes, changes that in the first instance anyway are very difficult to make for themselves individually and in their communities? It's a different version of exactly that same problem, the old tension between what those with expert knowledge have to tell us about the matters that are important and getting the people who are affected by those matters to make changes in their lives. And what the experience, that debate about civic humanism, about how you do it, how you reach out to people and make a difference in their lives, what that teaches us about now is this discomforting fact. I think it's discomforting when one first hears it, a bit, and then one realizes that that one just has to be more imaginative about it. And that is this. In trying to persuade the 18th century population of the British Isles to be patriotic and to feel that they are part of the great project in this society, to be motivated to make themselves certain sorts of people and to act in certain sorts of ways, the people doing this, the people with the conscious goal or plan of bringing about that effect, are, by having that goal, by the process of identifying it, and by setting up institutions like the Royal Academy, which are meant to see them through, are in fact being paternalistic. It's a top-down endeavour, that they've set up a structure in order to get something going, and what it is that they hope that they've got going is something that will be bottom-up. It'll make a difference at the grassroots level, and then will well up in the individual lives of people, change the way they behave. So we're being top-down and trying to get people to be bottom-up. We're being paternalistic and trying to encourage people to be autonomous in their behaviour. And there seems to be no way out of this dilemma. There's a paradox here at the very heart of the enterprise. You know, you have expert medical opinion now, which says that people take far too little exercise, and it's having a tremendous impact on individual health, on community health, and on society at large. I can't remember the figures off the top of my head now, but Scotland, I think, it costs Scotland over £1 billion a year, smoking and drinking and lack of exercise, in all sorts of ways. And there are all sorts of ways of adding up their cost. But that's a huge sum of money, but when you think about it, and that's the kind of thought that an economist or a politician might have. But just think of one person suffering the effects of chronic ill health, or one family who've lost a treasured member of it, and think about the emotional cost of that, and then multiply it by the many thousands of people who suffer in that way. And so, you know, you have this dilemma facing expert opinion and organised opinion, government and the bodies that advise government on health policy, who say, in fact, we have a crisis. You know, we have several aeroplane crashes worth every day of people who are suffering because of, you know, things that are going wrong in our society in these respects. And so we have to do something about it. And this is where, at the top, looking at the general figures, looking at the broad picture, you have this impetus, this aristocratic humanism, if you like, trying to find ways to make a difference of the right kind. And recognizing at the same time that the only way genuine differences can be made is to get people at the bottom to do it for themselves. And this is both an ethical and a practical consideration. It's an ethical one because autonomy in modern Western liberal democracies is a central value and a deeply important one. I mean, the great problem of liberalism really is the problem of what you do, how you deal with refusal. The refusal of an individual to take the advice or to improve his or her life or to stop smoking or whatever. Surely in a society like ours, if somebody says, no, I'm just not going to do it, I'm going to smoke 40 fags a day and I'm off to the pub, thank you very much indeed, and I'm not going to take any exercises, you know, I hate it. What can you do? Well, if you're a genuine liberal, genuine J.S. Mill-style liberal, you have to say, okay, that's fine, that's your choice, and that choice has to be respected so far as it goes. I mean, you might not in fact respect it, you might say to them, I think you're an idiot, but I'm not going to coerce you because I've got no right to do so. And so there, in the face of refusal, in the face of people who make conscious decisions, there's nothing one can do. But one knows, of course, that very many people, they probably want to be helped, but would love to get out of the pattern of behaviour that they're in, would like to be able to change their lifestyle, if only it could be done. And it's terribly hard to do. I mean, anybody who has ever tried to lose weight, I mean, after a certain amount has been put on, will know how very difficult it is to do. And in the face of that difficulty, and in the face of the fact that so many people have short-term problems that obscure longer-term goals, it's just undeniable that there is a felt need for help. Help from outside, help from the experts, help from people who can advise and do something that would respect your individuality and your autonomy, yes, but nevertheless didn't just leave you alone to flounder through the problem yourself. So the great dilemma that's faced here by the civic humanist impulse is to find that balance, to find the way in which the top-down process can nevertheless leave as much room for autonomy and as much respect for the liberty of the individual as possible, while nevertheless recognizing that there are people out there who want that helping hand, even as our paternalistic doctor, Parisian doctor, said sometimes in a paternalistic way, in order to achieve those goals that anybody rational would recognize as desirable. So if we look again at that conceptual history, the history of the concept of the good society and the good individual as it played itself out in the early modern period, what kind of solution was found to it? Well, the solution that in fact came out of those discussions in the 19th and 20th centuries was eventually an acceptance of a certain counsel of this fact. As the democratization of political structures in the Western world proceeded in the 19th and 20th century, you look back at this very slow and painful process of reforms of parliament in 1832 and 1867 and so on, then the enfranchisement of women in the early 20th century and the general democratization of society, so that the ambition of the Florentine humanists and the aristocratic humanists of the 18th century became etiolated. It became somehow less obviously a desideratum for people at the top end of society, recognizing that they had this mass of inertia, which was individual choices, that people would behave as they did, and that the state, if it went too far beyond a certain minimum, would only have counterproductive effects. I'll give you one particular example of that, the problem of taxation in relation to smoking and drinking as an instrument of health control. If you put taxes onto cigarettes up to a certain level, I mean even quite considerable taxes as there are now, what happens is that people who want to smoke or people who need to smoke because it helps them to deal with the stresses of poverty and other difficulties in their life will just divert resources from food to cigarettes. So you pile on the taxes and you're actually doing harm to the individual and that individual's family by diverting important resources that they have. If you put the taxes even higher, up to prohibitive levels, if it was a £20 tax per cigarette, for example, then what you would do is you would open the door for criminal activity and smuggling and the black market in cigarettes, and you would create the kind of problem or a simulacrum of it as the Americans had in the 1920s with prohibition of alcohol. So you have this great difficulty about the limits on public policy affecting the behavior of people and their choices and what they can do. Because there are certain limits to how much, for example, taxation can do before it introduces other sorts of difficulties, and how much harm it already does in the diversion of resources. So you have this tremendous difficulty that the organs of society have in trying to modify behavior and induce or coerce, even if rather gently, some lifestyle changes in people, in the hope of shifting the figures slightly. Again, from the point of view of Whitehall or somewhere, or Edinburgh, it's very hard to think in individual terms, but only in terms of numbers, of how much it's costing, how much smoking, for example, costs the National Health Service, or what the mortality and morbidity rates are associated with smoking, and trying to change those figures. Whereas in the ideal, of course, it's individuals and families in communities, people one might know and meet, on whose doors one might knock from time to time, with whom one might engage in conversation, whose lives one wants to change for their own intrinsic reasons, because it matters to those people and to their families. And that is something that could only ever be done at the grassroots level. And so what one has to recognize, therefore, is that great debate about civic humanism and how you induce changes in individual behavior in a society must carry with it something of the top down, something of the paternalistic, even if it's only in constructing a framework and setting goals and recognizing what the ideal should be. That this process that we're engaged in now is something of that kind. We're not now in a council estate, and we're not now wondering whether or not to have another cigarette or to go to the pub. Here we are, we're thinking about the general problem. And so we're part of the structure, the top-down structure, which is making decisions about things actually on other people's behalf. And so one of the tricks that has to be done best, and which we must try imaginatively to cope with, is how we can translate, how we can interface, so to speak, that top-down approach to these matters, to the whole question of public health, with the need for getting those changes that can only happen if they happen at the grassroots level, finding those inducements, those incentives, those motivations for people, individuals at the grassroots level, to make the changes for themselves. Here is a parallel. I always say to my students at the university that I can't, however much I would love to, do the work for them. I can't learn the stuff on their behalf. They have to do it themselves. What I can do is, give them a bit of advice about what to read, what direction to point themselves in, try and motivate them. I always think that if at the end of a lecture, at least half the people in the audience are thinking to themselves, oh, I'd really like to find out more about that, it's just so fascinating, then you would have done your job as a teacher, but you certainly can't do much more than that because you really can't do it for them, can't learn it for them. And I say to them also, I say, look, if I ask you to stay in your seats at the end of this lecture, in order to hear me give the same lecture again, you would be bored stiff. But if at the end of the lecture I asked any one of you to stand up and give the lecture I've just given, you would find that you probably couldn't do it. And that's a very puzzling seeming paradox, isn't it? If you were bored because you've heard it, why shouldn't you be able to give it? And the answer is that when you sit and listen to a lecture, it's only passive knowledge that you've acquired, if you've acquired anything. Education psychologists say people only hear 25% of what the lecturer says, which is the point of repeating it four times if you can. But it's only passive knowledge at best. And to make it, to activate it, to make it your own so that you can put it to work, you have to go and do something. Go home and tell the people in the kitchen in your hall of residence what you've been doing today and what you've learned today. Or write an essay or read a book or go and find out the information, but somehow or other take action yourself. And the parallel here with our problem in public health is exactly that. That unless people themselves see the point and have a reason which is one of being moved to take action and to make a difference to their own lives, no amount of being told how bad it is for them not to exercise and to smoke and to drink is going to make that much of a difference for them. I don't want to rule out the fact, by the way, that top-down initiatives can make a difference. Dr. Bryan, the director of the heart disease unit in the Department of Health, in a letter today, if you look in today's Independent, claims, I think probably the justification, that the big government exercise in 2004 on smoking did have an effect. It actually just knocked the figures down a little bit. So if the adverts are sufficiently compelling and so on, they can make a difference to individual behaviour. But real long-term change, real personalised individual change, can't come from anywhere else but from the bottom. And so the great task that people in public health have, really, is to find those really imaginative ways of going from the top-down approach, being the authority figures, having the expertise, knowing the figures and so on, to motivating people from the grassroots level. That's the trick. And it very probably is something that wouldn't be done by giving lectures on public health or on smoking or drinking, but in some completely different way, from a different angle, an angle that got at people, not through their minds, I don't imagine, but very probably through their hearts, some way. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for that. We have some time for questions or points of development if somebody wishes to volunteer. If you're going to ask a question or say something, it would be really helpful if you could say who you are just before you make your point or ask your question. Heather first, and then.
Hi, my name is Heather Stone, and I run an organisation called Space Unlimited. I mean, that was just fantastic. What I would really like to get a few for is I'm very, very struck by the notion that I think particularly comes from coaching about being of service to people. And I just wondered whether listening particularly to those final words that you were saying there about how you perhaps can play a role in a top-down initiative that is still actually effective. And I wonder if the mindset of being of service is actually one that can help find some of the answers.
I'm sure it can. I mean, I think I'd want, you know, under the example of those sorts of initiatives and things like Alcoholics Anonymous and others, where there is genuine teamwork between the people who are bringing the expertise and the people who are benefiting from it, that genuine differences can be made. I think that the main point of concern really is how little advice and information sticks with people if it really does come from on high to, you know, something putatively lower. So just general information or information in advertising or newspaper articles and so on tends to have very little impact on people. I mean, how many people read probably every week something related to the dangers of excessive drinking and of smoking and the rest, and whose behaviour is not at all modified? I mean, the people who are very often most addressed in this matter are, you know, that crucial age group between 20 and 24 who do most smoking in our community. And you think, oh, well, it's something they can defer, they can put it off until later, it's okay now, it's cool to do it now, and they're not going to change their behaviour. And yet they're bombarded with information. It's that gap, you know, the gap between the information available and the practice that results from knowing the information, which really matters here. I think you're dead right, though. Co-working, co-learning, discovery is a very potent way of doing it, but then there are big resource implications there.
Thank you. I'm David Cormier from the Dental School in Dublin. I'm interested to see your take on the complex interaction between behaviours, lifestyles, and life circumstances, socioeconomic circumstances. You didn't really touch on that, but I'm wondering whether the problems that we have today and that they had in the past was in a way of trying to avoid the real issues of the circumstances by trying to have this kind of behaviour top-down approach without actually addressing the inequality.
Yes, it's a very good point that, because had we world enough and time, one thing that one would very much like to explore in the 18th century debate about the good society and how you persuade everybody to be participants in it would be precisely this idea, very, very common in that debate, that your circumstances, however poor you are, and whatever part of town you live in or whatever part of the country, however little education you have and so on, it doesn't have any impact at all on the question whether or not you could be a good citizen, that you could acquire and understand and put into practice the public virtues. Public virtues, by the way, are separate from the private virtues. These are terms about much used when people talk about Shaftesbury and David Hume and Adam Smith and others in the 18th century, because and Bernard Mandeville and others, who recognised that a sense of active commitment to the community, a sense of the responsibility one has as a beneficiary of membership of the community, the fact that the social contract is a two-way contract and that you therefore have certain kinds of obligations, those addressed the questions of public virtue. Now, if it was a virtuous thing to be a good citizen in the sense that your private virtues matched what was required of you in your role as a member of society, as a citizen, then you would be expected to, no matter what your circumstances or your environmental conditions, you would be expected to live up to the ideals of those private virtues. Now, as the implication of your question is, that with the increase of urbanisation and the nature of living conditions that people experienced, for example, in the 19th and early 20th century in industrial societies, people began to recognise that environmental factors more often than not trumped the possibilities for people living in those communities to better themselves and to be good citizens and to exercise the public virtues. This is precisely why, you know, in Victorian times, and people make a mistake, they think the Victorian times were very moralistic and upright and covering up the piano legs and what have you. But the reason why people... Samuel Smiles wrote Self-Help and people put out all these tracts on temperance and everything else is because, in fact, society was the other way around. What was actually happening on the ground was the very reverse of what these books were enjoining. Samuel Smiles wrote Self-Help precisely because it was so difficult to help yourself for so many people in the circumstances in which they were mired. All the more admirable, therefore, if a few individuals here and there, by tremendous endeavour and sort of native endowment of intelligence and the rest, could break out of that trap that they were in. But it took really the social reformers of the later part of the 19th century and, you know, socialism, that's a permissible word still in our society in parts of the 20th century, to make a difference to the actual material conditions of people as a condition of their educational and spiritual and emotional and moral improvement. And that was something that was very, very hard learned. It was hard learned through the decades of the worst phases of industrialization. So the legacy of that lesson, I suppose, in connection with your question, therefore, is that you know, everything that one does in the way of dealing with individuals and communities on the public health front would in the end be ineffective if it wasn't paralleled by really genuine political action and economic action on the other front, because, you know, we all know that economic inequalities are immediately expressed in health inequalities as well. And that's a lesson that nobody can dispute now.
Carol first, thank you.
Carol Tannehill, Director of the Glasgow Centre. I wondered if you could say a bit more about what it would mean to be a good citizen now in a much more globalised society, and how these concepts of private virtue and public virtue play out when it's the world so much more mobile. And the concept of the community we belong to is quite different. It's not so geographically defined, perhaps, as it was in the historical times you described.
Well, of course, it's the fascinating point, isn't it, about our contemporary world, that just as it's so much more globalised and so much more one place, so it's also, at the same time, a much more diverse place, partly because that diversity is respected and encouraged in some respects, especially in Western countries. And so you see the diminution of options in one respect because of the pressure of a globalized economic regime. But on the other hand, you see a sort of rapidly increasing pluralism and diversity, and with it an ethics that says that diversity is in itself good, and that people whose choices, whose preferences, whose lifestyles are very different from your own, nevertheless merit from you being given the space to live like that under the principle of harm, you know, do no harm to others and do not fear of others. Although, of course, that the conflict between pluralism and the harm principle is always present in all societies. In a way, these parallel facts of increasing globalization, increasing diversity, provide an opportunity, because one would expect to learn from diversity how to cope with some of the pressures of globalization. Developing economies, for example, which are going very rapidly through phases that Western economies went through much more slowly in the past, could learn something from that experience and try to obviate the worst difficulties of them, including on the health front, environmental and health front. In fact, they don't. I mean, if you look at China, you know, it's a time bomb waiting to happen on the environmental and health fronts because of a variety of considerations. But you would expect an imaginative response anyway to the globalization process to being able to use the lessons that diversity teaches to cope with them. And one has to hope that people are sufficiently either rational or self-interested to apply those things. Self-interested in this sense, that, you know, big corporations like things like peace and stability and a degree of education in the labouring populations of third world countries they go into to build plants in and so on, because it reflects well on profits, on dividends. And so, you know, it's Bernard Mandeville again, public vices turn out to have sort of private virtues here, but there is a beneficial knock-on from the fact that a globalised economy requires the world to be, genuinely speaking, a peaceful and progressive place, largely. I know that some conspiracy theories about how profitable wars are and everything else are probably true sometimes, but generally speaking, the drive is towards an improvement in those respects in the health of local communities and the rest, rather than the reverse.
I think I was guest from the Commission for Racial Caucus. Interested in your point at the beginning that participation equaled good health. And I think with the hierarchical systems that we have in place these days, that leads to participation often being at the bottom of the system or being an afterthought. I'd be interested in what you think opportunities for mapping participation to look at the numbers that are participating when, you know, in this day and the belief in participation, when more people will vote for Big Brother than will vote necessarily in a local or general election. And the numbers that you need now to get elected to a political party is quite frightening.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. In fact, there are two points, but they're connected ones in your remarks there. One is the sense of how individuals flourish if they believe that they have a role, that they can participate, and their participation makes a difference. That's one question. And the other is the problem of motivation to participate in processes like local elections, for example, which don't seem to be so interesting and colourful and the rest as voting for who should stay in the Big Brother house. And the connection between the two is that the incentive to be a participator in the second sense seems to be lacking in the case of local elections, perhaps because people don't believe it is going to have that big an impact on their lives. This introduces the much larger issue of local democracy and local autonomy and what powers, in fact, local authorities have. If local authorities have much greater powers, then perhaps people would be much more concerned about who was exercising those powers. But while they tend to look after the drains and things that people don't think are of immediate concern to them, then the incentives are much lower. But on the question of participation, there is a very rich field for further investigation. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, and I think some quantified evidence as well, that feeling that you are an appreciated part of a process is very often more important to people even than how much money they're earning, for example. I mean, I know that how much money people are earning does matter to them, but in situations which the euphemism labour flexibility applies to, you know, where you can lose your job very quickly and where you are on part-time contracts instead of having employment security, and where you're never given a pat on the back or a reward or a congratulation for what you do, your sense of being a participant in that process and a valued one is much less than in the old-fashioned way, the iron rice bowl situation which Western economies once had in common with China, where you were a member of that family, you were part of that project. And that is where the link between, in that first sense, participation and well-being, flourishing and therefore health, comes in. Because if you've got job security, if you feel a valued member of the group that you're working with, your levels of stress are going to be much lower and you're going to get support from the people that you're with. And in all these very, very subtle ways that feed in real terms into general well-being, you're going to be a beneficiary. If you live in a very competitive, very insecure social and employment environment, stress levels are going to be higher and presumably all the other health indicators are going to follow suit. And it's in that sense that feeling whether you're part of something, feeling whether you're a member of a community or the workforce or whatever, really does have a big impact on your overall well-being, including your health.
Anybody else got a question? Jennifer?
Jennifer Williams, Centre for Communities and London. I'm really interested in this territory of the translating from, and I see a lot of very rich innovation in people's minds and in institutions and individuals, and I'd like to link that then with where does the leadership for taking this forward come from? Because it seems that leadership in all of our fields is such a crisis, especially in this area of translating the new innovation that we're finding and getting people to participate in the way you're talking.
Yeah. There are a lot of difficulties there, aren't there? One of them is the very nature of bureaucracy and of bureaucratic structures and of accountability and of the anxiety that people in the middle of the structure have about being accountable and responsible, blaming if something goes wrong and so on. And there is that difficulty. And by the way, this difficulty, again, if we had well enough time, is a direct outcome of this great debate about civic humanism for the following reason. That the Florentine humanists recognized, when they were talking about how you would construct a good society, they recognized that if a society is run by powerful individuals, powerful families, or very rich people, or condottieri, mercenary princes, or whatever, that the result is corruption. Because in order to influence those powerful individuals, you have to be able to bribe somebody who works for them, or get access. There's no formula, there's no transparent public process that you can go through which is fair to everybody who's involved in that process. And so, where you have independent, powerful individuals, and that very natural corollary of it is corruption. And it is for that reason that in Western liberal democracies, the bureaucratic form of government was evolved. Because it, in the ideal anyway, provides a fair, even playing field with the process that people have got to go through in order to achieve a certain goal, and they do it on a path that everybody else is trying to achieve that goal also. So there is a due process, there are rules and regulations laid down, it's governed by law, there's redress if things go wrong, you can appeal from decisions and so on. And that was meant to displace the individual patronage of powerful people and the corruption that carries with it. But the downside of the bureaucratic process is that it becomes over-bureaucratized. It diffuses responsibility, so nobody is the person who says yes or no at the end of the process and makes a final decision. It's always deferred to some other committee and takes months, and you get that kind of problem too. And so authority dissipates. It's like a river running into the sand rather than ending up with somebody who could really make a decision. These are institutional and political problems, and it's perfectly, I think, reasonable to argue that part of the public health difficulty in this country just is on the delivery mechanisms and on targeting the money in the right place and choosing the right priorities and the rest of it, just because of the structure. And that applies to almost all aspects of our society. And in many ways, it may be too high a cost to pay for what we hope to be the accountability and transparency. And I mean, just in that connection, I'll tell you the following anecdote that an acquaintance of mine who came to this country from South America just a couple of years ago, his wife had to get a British driving license. And she went and took a test and failed. And so she said to the driving instructor, "Well, how much is it going to be for me to pass?" And he looked at her in complete astonishment. "What do you mean? Well, how much do you want to pass me?" "Well, this is a very, very different world, in a way." And she was frightfully impressed that he wouldn't take a bribe. Instead, so absolutely impressive. And now she loves Britain. She thinks it's a great country because of that. But you could point out to her that the downside of that is that it's going to take her longer to get her bribe.
Was there a question over here? I've recently been in India, as some of you will know, and I was very impressed by a statue of Gandhi, which is on the site of his cremation. And the statue of Gandhi has him striding out wearing a loincloth and carrying a stick, and there are people following him. And I was very struck by the fact that they're not following him because they expect to be beaten with the stick if they don't, nor are they following him because of his great wealth, because it's quite clear that he doesn't have great wealth. He's dressed only in a piece of scatty old cloth that you wouldn't wipe the floor with at home. They're following him, I think, because they see something of their own aspirations and his aspirations. And there's that kind of reciprocity of what you were calling co-creation there. And one of the things, I'm going to indulge myself and ask a question, if I may. Because one of the things that I'm really interested in since you came last and talked to us about civic conversation is that I think civic conversation might be a way for us to unfold some of these issues that you've been talking about. So rather than prescribing particular forms of action for people who are not oneself, that one gets into a conversation with people about what the hopes and aspirations might be for the city and how we might achieve those, so that we create meaning rather than dictate meaning.
Yes.
And I just wonder how that fitted with the kind of conversation about the good and the kind of whole idea of civic humanism. Is that in that tradition? Or?
Well, I think it is very much. And what it ties in with is the idea that, in fact, meaning, aspiration, value is already there. It's already down there at the grassroots level, waiting to be liberated and given an opportunity to express itself. Mm-hmm. I was telling Andrew earlier, one thing I do is I'm a fellow of the World Economic Forum. This is a gathering of all the sort of fat cats and the big politicians and things in Davos. And one of the committees that I sit on is a committee called the Committee on the Responsible Use of Private Wealth. And until I became a member of this committee, I didn't really understand what private wealth meant in real terms. And it's sort of frightening in a way the number of people who are what bankers call ultra-high net worth individuals. They have hundreds of millions of dollars of recurrent income every year, more than they could possibly spend in any number of lifetimes. And some of them, to their great credit, are anxious to do something with their money. Give to charity or create foundations, and they want to do it responsibly and ethically, but they want to give money to a charity which is under, you know, the constraints of the Charity Commission is having to invest it at the highest possible return, trustees that is, so that they can get the charitable purposes fulfilled, and therefore have the money go to the arms industry or something. But they want to try and do it as responsibly as possible. And many of them are very interested in this business of identifying those sort of bottlenecks out there in the world, or those crucial imaginative places where if they could just apply some, you know, couple of million dollars to it, it would just, you know, really open up a tap of imagination and energy at the local level that could help itself. Because I mean, these are not fools, these people who make all this kind of money, most of them, and they realize that if you can't just keep, it doesn't really help people if you just keep pouring money at them again top down, but if it really does something to change the way they can run their own lives. And so they're constantly looking for these opportunities to try to untap the possibilities. And I was tremendously struck by a remark made by a young Egyptian woman who was in one of the consultative groups on this. And she said, you know, it's a very interesting thing that when men are sitting around talking about some initiative and some problem, the first question they ask themselves is, now where are we going to get the funding for it? But when women are sitting around in their community talking about some initiatives, they say, now what have we got to hand already? And it's that, you know, that the fact that they've got things to hand already out there in their communities, that if you could unleash those or give people the opportunity to use them somehow, really to get down there, that already there's the meaning and everything is already waiting to be tapped. I mean, human beings are such energetic and imaginative and creative apes, if only they could be given the opportunity to express all those things. And the crushing routines of life and poverty and the rest are what, you know, throw a big thick blanket over. But if only somehow or other, you know, that blanket could be lifted some corner of it, then all that is going to come out.
Anybody else? Burning questions? Something you absolutely must say before you leave the room? No? Okay, well, just before I ask you to join us in the room at the back for something to eat and drink, it's been my great pleasure to thank Anthony for giving us food for thought. I'm going away with fresh ideas about inequality and translation and participation. I'm trying to tie all that up in 2,000 years of thinking about this, which is what always happens to me when we meet, so I'm very grateful for that. I'm really keen and personally very interested to try and turn some of these ideas into something practical in Glasgow, and I wish to be held to account for that. So if you meet me in the street and nothing's happening, please give me a round, and I'll try and do something with it. So it just remains for me to say thank you again, Anthony, and please come and join us next door for something to eat and drink. Thank you very much.